Hello and welcome to the Weekly Space Hangout for Wednesday, June 24th, 2020. I'm Fraser Cain, publisher of Universe Today. This week, we're going to be talking about Mars launches coming up in July, comets that will grace the nighttime sky, an eclipse, two conjunctions, either the lightest neutron star or the heaviest neutron star or the lightest known black hole. And surprise, surprise, another starship explodes, but this time on purpose. Joining me this week, I've got on my screen, Dave Dickinson. David.
Hey, fresh off the virtual star party from Sunday night.
Yeah. You've recovered?
I think I'm the only one that overlaps other than you.
Yeah, it's only been a couple of days since I've seen you. We've got Pam Hoffman. Pam, how's it going?
Awesome, thanks.
And we got Michael Roderick. Michael.
Good to be back.
And Michael, you didn't know, but you were featured in my latest question show last week, or 2 weeks ago. Yeah, I'll send you a link if you don't already have it. But if you search for your name on Google and my name,
I never do that.
No,
ever.
I know. Who Googles himself? Yeah, but yeah, if you search for your name and on my YouTube channel, you should find it. But I'll send you a link afterwards. But it was great, and of course, this was another one of the interviews that we recorded at the American Astronomical Society back in January. We had so many. I feel like we had like 15 of them or something. So it was great. And it just feels like a lifetime ago. So long ago. Back in the before times. All right. All right. So before we get into this week's news roundup, we've got an interview with Elizabeth Howell, who was a columnist for Universe Today and a very prolific space journalist. And she has not one, not two, but three books coming out over the next couple of months. So we have a great interview that goes for about 20 minutes. So whenever we have a pre-recorded interview, we will go with the news portion first. I'll say goodbye to my co-hosts, and then we will shift over and actually do the interview portion of this. And also, just another reminder, of course, as we are nearing, this is the second to last episode of the Weekly Space Hangout before we go into our summer hiatus. So I encourage you once again to sign up for the Weekly Space Hangout crew. This is the community. These are the executive producers of the show. They will be glad to talk with you about space news. It gives you access to this great community. You can see the Slack down here, and they will help you teach you how to be an executive producer. If you have any interest in talking to astronauts, this is a good way to do it. So go to wshcrew.space, and they will give you everything you need to join. Totally free. Just be part of the community that runs this show. And I literally mean this. They are in charge. I am their humble servant. So you get to be in charge of me. All right. Let's move on to this week's news portion. Michael, you're on my screen. Tell us about this weird thing that was seen.
Okay. So hopefully you've all heard of LIGO. It is a different kind of observatory. We're not looking at, not really looking at space. We're kind of trying to measure the deformation of space. So the way that you can deform space is by using really heavy objects. So heavy or dense objects like a neutron star or a black hole. And as these two things kind of spiral in towards each other, they generate something called gravitational waves. And so that is essentially moving the fabric of space itself. And so with LIGO, we can actually detect those ripples of space from these very massive and dense objects. And so LIGO's found, I want to say like 30 black hole mergers, several black hole mergers.
It's finding about one a week.
Yeah. And this one, actually, it was found about last year in August 2019. And they're now publishing the data because you got to be very careful about these things. There's so many things that can create a false signal if a truck goes by, if you have thunder, if, you know, someone jumps up and down where they shouldn't be. And so after all this analysis, they found that this particular merger features a black hole, which they believe is about 23 times the mass of the sun, and some other object, which is about 2.6 times the mass of the sun.
Whoa.
And that's a huge discrepancy between these objects. And the really fascinating thing is that this mass of 2.6 it lies like right around the boundary of how massive we think a neutron star can be. So at some point, if it gets too massive, it'll collapse, become a black hole. If it's less massive than, you know, this limit that we're not really sure of, then it just remains a neutron star. So this object then is either the most massive neutron star we've ever found or the least massive black hole, which either way, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So
And so, I mean, I guess the if it was a neutron star, then in theory there should be some kind of flash of radiation as it's getting torn up, right? Just before it goes in.
Well, the problem is that you've got the black hole on the other end, and that can kind of
Gobble up all the
disrupt.
yeah.
Yeah.
And
So
so
this one, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah. So if you had two neutron stars colliding with one another, then you get the kilanova we saw. You get that flash of radiation, and it's very clear. But if you have a black hole hitting a neutron star, then the neutron star could just go and just go in.
Yeah. And the problem with this one is that it's a bit further away than the neutron star merger that we saw. So this one is at 240 megaparsecs, just still kind of close in astronomical sense. But it's pretty far away, so if there was a flash, we probably wouldn't have seen it. We did follow up observations with telescopes to try to find something, and nothing was seen.
Right. Now, so let's kind of run through these options then, because there's a third option as well, right? I mean, you've got the black hole and the neutron star. So, like, how close to that limit do they think this mass is?
So, like right on the edge,
Right on
maybe.
the edge, right on the edge.
It's not fast,
So
right? 2.5 was the previous, and now it's 2.6. I was reading that this morning,
the
just right
I
behind
think
it.
the most massive potential neutron star they have that we know of is 2.7 times the mass of the sun. But
Okay.
that's, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that go into that. So that
Yeah.
could be smaller based on the assumptions they made to get that calculation. So yeah, you look at the distribution we're at, like, you know, 1.5 is the limit, where if it's below that, it's a white dwarf, above that, it's a neutron star. And so everything is like right around 1.5, with a few that scatter up to about two.
Right. So the third idea is that it could be a quark star, right?
Oh.
Quark stars, man. I don't know enough to say anything about those.
Well,
I know
so
there's.
the idea is that there is another kind of object, this quark star, that is right in between the neutron star and the black hole, and it is, and so you have a neutron star that's in some kind of binary companion with some other object, and it is gobbling up material from that object, and then it collapses down into a soup of quarks, but it doesn't actually switch over into a black hole. So
I don't think we found any
yeah.
examples, have we, of those. I think they're still theor I think they're
Still
still
all
theoretical.
theory.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
think. Yeah. I don't know if we found
And
an answer to that. There
I
should
would
be,
have to
though.
imagine the limit between a quark star, like neutron star, quark star, black hole, has got to be extremely tiny
Yeah.
before you just go, you know, full
Yeah.
in the black hole.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, the crazy part about this is that you get this incredible discovery, this incredible like detection, but then there's no real way to do any follow-up observations. The people looked, there was no X-ray burst, so all it is just purely mass, and then that's it. So
Most
I
of
think they
LIGO
use
is kind of.
Fermi to do the like try to get the gamma ray if they
Yeah.
can get the gamma ray burst.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think at this point most of LIGO is kind of statistics, like trying to get a number, a handle on how many of these objects are actually out there. Because we never saw these intermediate mass black holes, the ones that are, you know, 30 times the mass of the sun. We never saw those until LIGO. Now we've got these maybe potentially really, really
Kind
tiny
of
black holes
amazing.
that exist.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I got to tour both LIGO facilities, and it's amazing that they kind of like went on in obscurity for about a decade before they made their first. I managed to go to the Hannaford one in Washington, they were doing the advanced LIGO upgrade, so they had the system was down for about a year. But
when did you go? What year?
That would have been 2014. Yeah, as we went through Washington State. And they were pretty confident Advanced LIGO was going to. Ironically, I had a press invite to, we knew a week or two prior that they probably had discovered gravitational waves. And I got a press invite to it. And just what I had going on at that time, I just could not make it. But I told my wife, it's like, I'm pretty sure they discovered gravitational waves, because they wouldn't be sending out to this many journalists to telling them to come to. A lot of people are like, what's LIGO?
Yeah.
It's like nobody had ever heard of it.
Yeah,
but it's a really fascinating. So
I'm not sure if I mentioned it here, but I worked at the Hanford Observatory for 4 years, from 2009 to 2013. And no one in our town knew what LIGO was. They tell me, "Yeah, I work out at LIGO." What the hell?
It doesn't turn out pretty pictures. Sure. Though.
It's in the city.
yeah, it's like looking at seismographs.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's not quite as exciting. With them detecting, like, you know, one interaction every week, do you think that it is, I mean, was this ever back in, like, how long ago were you there?
So I was there at the end of the initial observing run, like the initial.
Like before Advanced LIGO?
The LIGO before Advanced LIGO.
So before they'd even made a single detection.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I worked there for the upgrade, so I worked on the laser and get that.
Isn't there another upgrade they want to do, enhanced LIGO or something like that?
Hmm. Yeah.
Beyond advanced LIGO
plus or something.
Yeah.
There is another upgrade they want to do.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, it's another mystery. We need to find more of these. We need to do, I mean, if it is a quark star, that's pretty great. That's a brand new object that could be out there potentially. So, all right. Pam Hoffman.
So thanks a lot. I really like to talk to people about things they can do. And we've got a couple of nice conjunctions coming up in the evening, June the 28th, Jupiter and Pluto.
So once again, can you just let people know what a conjunction is? So people.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. This is a really great time to see things that are close together. And we've seen a lot of them with the moon and Venus, that kind of thing. If you've been driving westward in the evening, you may have seen both of those together, like a little crescent moon and a really bright, you know, it looks like a star, but it's very, very bright. That would be Venus.
It's not a UFO.
No, it's very often mistaken for a UFO.
Yeah.
But these will be in the evening. In this case, June the 28th is Jupiter and Pluto. And I really love when a big planet is next to a little planet like Pluto, and hard to see because then it's easier to, you know, and you need a telescope in this case for Pluto. You can actually use Jupiter as sort of a guidepost to find Pluto. And I love telling people about these. And I know it's hard to see, like you might see Mercury and Venus together, and you can see them very well. But this is a great time to try and find Pluto because you have
Jupiter. That is so cool. How close will they get? Do you know their closest point?
Yeah, no, I haven't looked that up yet. Okay. But these are usually within a few degrees. And if you stretch out your arm, and you put up your little pinky finger, that's 1 degree, and like your hand, your fist is about 10 degrees. So between those two, that's what's generally what conjunctions
are. Right. And so potentially if you've got like a wide field telescope, you could get both in the same field of view.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you've got to figure out, like, Jupiter's going to be obvious, but then you got to figure out which of those little dots in your field of view is actually Pluto.
Yeah, I think it'll look a little different than the stars will. Because I've looked at a lot of things, you know, when you look at Jupiter, you'll see the moons around it. But I think you'll see something else that looks a little different than the stars, a little different than Jupiter's moons. And that should be Pluto. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
I'm going to
rabbit hole for a second here, but like people want to be able to take pictures of the International Space Station. And it's really tough to be able to know exactly when and where the International Space Station is going to be. But there are these websites that allow you to calculate when and where you would be able to see the space station pass directly in front of the sun or the moon.
Oh,
and, okay. And so you go down to that location, and because the space station will be passing through the shadow of the Earth, you won't actually see it. but it will, but you just, you at the right, at the appointed time, you turn on your camera, you record video, and then you look at the video afterwards, and at the exact moment, boom, you got the space station, passes right in front of the moon, and you got a picture of the space station. So it's a trick.
Cal Sky and it's Transit Finder, I think, is the app.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Two good sites that'll do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think you can take a picture of it, can you? I mean, video is going to be the way to go.
Yeah, you want to go via, yeah, the way you would time it.
Yeah, you want video running.
Yeah, you run a video on it, and then afterwards you look through your whole video and you go, there it is.
The transit is usually less than a second. Yeah, when it goes in front of the sun or moon, so it's very quick. Wow. So,
yeah,
so
that is quick.
Yeah,
I have caught it before. But.
So conjunction number one is Pluto and Jupiter, which is I've never heard of anyone mentioning that. That's why I'm kind of getting pretty excited about this. What's the other one, Pam?
July the 6th will be Saturn and the Moon, also in the evening, and then we got a between those two, we're going to have, and this is so cool because it's really fun for the United States. On July 4th into the 5th, there's a penumbral eclipse of the moon. In other words, this is just a part of the Earth will be, you know, obscuring the moon from the sun. So for here, we start celebrating in the evening, and this is kind of a cool way, you know, if you don't want to look at the if you don't want to look at fireworks,
yeah,
you can try and see this eclipse of the moon. Most of North America. I'm so sorry, Fraser. It will not be in the northern part.
You know what? Penumbral eclipses are boring. It's great to know that it happens, and I have actually gone out and watched a penumbral lunar eclipse, and you do sort of see the moon.
It dims a little bit, right?
Yeah, it darkens. It dims just a little bit. It's more obvious when there's a total lunar eclipse coming, and you can sort of see the penumbral first, and then you see that actual shadow start to take chomps into it. But,
right. No, had two shadows.
Yeah, yeah.
You can do is take a photo before, during, and after, and you do see the difference.
Yeah.
It's like a little tea-colored shading on the moon. Yeah. A few years ago, we had a penumbral eclipse a few years ago, and it was a strange – there was a huge amount of – you know how things on the internet just kind of get blown up? And there was a huge amount of interest, and I had to keep feeling – it's like, you know, this is just a penumbral. It's not that awesome, but – I actually ended up live streaming it anyway because there were just so many people were talking about it.
Very cool. It's like the supermoon. It's kind of not that big a deal for us who have been observing for a while, but everybody gets excited when there's a supermoon.
Yeah.
So I'm on board for that.
Yeah,
an eclipse on July 4th in 2020 sounds very ominous. So I'm a little, I might stay inside.
But we just had the... We just had the solar eclipse, the annular solar eclipse, and of course the way the timings of these eclipses, they come in packs. So you get the annular eclipse, or you get, you know, some kind of solar eclipse, and then you'll often get that lunar eclipse very shortly afterwards, often the next month.
We're in eclipse season, where the nodes along the ecliptic are lined up. So
okay, and there's generally about 4 to 6 a year. And we won't see another one of any kind until November, but I'm going to just talk about when they start. You'll pretty much most of North America, you'll see it from like 8 p.m., 9 p.m., 10 p.m., 11 p.m., depending on where you are. So West Coast, early 8 p.m., East Coast, 11 p.m., and it'll last about 3 hours. And that's about right for a penumbral. I mean, you know, the total eclipse, that's kind of like 6 or 7 hours. So that makes total sense that it's only like 3 hours.
Yeah. 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 That's awesome. You know, it's, you know, this is, I think, the last we're going to see of you, Pam, before we move into next season. I don't know if you're going to join us next season. What else should people, I mean, you've got now 2 months of recommendations. So beyond these ones that are just coming up, do you have any more just general recommendations for people to take advantage of the summer and the night sky?
Yeah, actually, what I'm going to do for you is in the notes below the comments, I'm going to go ahead and put, you know, I've combined a whole bunch of different resources into a big list of what's happening for the whole rest of the year, 2020.
Yep.
And I'll start putting 2021 in as well soon. So I'll put a link to that and the information I just described today. So
fantastic.
Yeah, in the comments.
Okay, Pam, I think we need to do this again. That was me tossing you a softball to promote your book.
Oh, got it. Yes, sir. I thought you wanted to do it at the end.
Well, I do, but you were gonna give some copies away, right?
Yeah. Actually, you know, with the shutdown, I haven't been able to get to Star Parties, and I used to teach a class where I would sell the books. I have 100 of them sitting in a box. I'm thinking I will go ahead and offer them for free. You know, please pay the shipping for it. And we'll work in a membership site too. So here's the book, and watch for that. I'll go ahead and put that in the
FaceHangout
comments too, because that should be ready really soon.
Okay, so we'll put a link in the show notes. But if people want to participate in this, they're going to go to your website. Where are they going to go?
I'm creating a whole new membership site, but pam@everydayspacer.com is a great way to.
Okay.
Next week, and ask about free book. Just put free book.
Awesome. Okay.
I mean, email.
And yes, what is the name of your book?
It's Your Amazing Itty Bitty Explore Space Now. It's 15 simple ways to personally and directly get involved with space exploration and science and astronomy.
Terrific.
Really fun stuff.
That's great, Pamela. Thank you. That's very kind of you. And I know people will be excited to check out the book.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. Dave, what have you got for us?
Well, once we turn the calendar over to July, we're not really talking about this yet, but we're going to be some of the biggest space missions of the year are coming up. It's going to be all Mars all the time because we're entering the Mars launch window for 2020, the window that comes around every 24 months when it's the optimal time to launch missions to Mars. Originally, 4 missions were going to go, and one of them, due to technical problems they're having with the European Space Agency's Rosalind Franklin lander, that got bumped back to 2022. But we have 3 missions that are still going, and we were kind of, when the pandemic and everything happened, we were a little worried about Perseverance, but they said this is a very high priority mission. It would actually cost them more to shelf Perseverance.
Yeah.
And as you saw what happened to the Galileo orbiter back in the 90s after Challenger, when they shelved that, and they think that directly caused the problems with the antenna that wouldn't open later on. So they definitely don't like to do this kind of thing where if a mission's ready to go, they like to send it off. We have 3 missions coming up. United Arab Emirates, actually a newcomer to the Mars game, is launching Mars Hope it's launching on a Japanese rocket from Tanegashima in Japan on July 14th, and that's just an orbiter. But still, this is United Arab Emirates' first interplanetary mission, so it's going to be kind of interesting. Perseverance, that was newly named a few months ago, that's launching on July 20th. I think they have about a 2-week window generally. If I remember from the Curiosity launch, they've got a few weeks to do it, but they're going right at the beginning of the window. That's arriving at Mars at Jezero Crater on February 2021. And the Chinese Space Agency is launching the Tinawarin. This is going to be an orbiter, lander, and rover. And that's going just a few days later in the window on July 23rd. And that's going to land on April 2021 as well, about a month or two after Perseverance. Chinese Space Agency is always kind of an enigma as far as getting things out to the press and doing press releases. I've tried really hard to get some internal contacts there.
Yep. So do you want to hear how crazy I've gone in trying to do this?
I've heard you're trying to learn Chinese.
I am learning to speak Chinese. I practice
Mandarin?
For hours. Yeah, Mandarin. I practice 2 to 3 hours every day learning to speak Chinese. And
you know, that's like a level 4 in difficulty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's like not it is not an easy language. But I took
Arabic 101, and that's kind of the same
level.
It's
a
very difficult language.
But literally all I care about is so that I can understand what China is up to in space exploration and to be able to start interviewing people in China about what they're doing. Because
Andrew Jones is pretty good for.
He's the best.
There's a lot of observers of the Chinese space program, but they don't do a lot for press releases.
Yeah.
Or
no, they're terrible. And so I think somebody needs to help them explain, because I think that they're doing a lot of amazing things, and they should do a better job of getting the word out about what they're working on.
This is going on their new heavy rocket too. I think it's only launched a couple times, the Long March 5. So
yeah,
But perseverance too. That's you know, with the whole pandemic problem, it's like what we had with Crew Dragon. All the space geeks in the community right now, we all want to go down. There's part of me that's like, you know, Florida is only a long day drive to go down for the launch.
Yeah,
I did. I went to the Curiosity launch back when I was down there. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I think it's going to be very limited as far as what they're going to do for press, like with the Crew Dragon launch. So I got a feeling we'll be watching this one at home, which is okay. It's easier to write about it.
Yeah, we tried to get on press credentials for the Crew Dragon launch, and some people made it, but we didn't. So we're still waiting on other. Hopefully, we'll apply again for the Perseverance launch, and we'll see if we can actually get a photographer out at that launch.
Yeah, it's only a long day drive from here. I'd love to go out there, but it's. Yeah, and this is going to be the first nuclear RTG launch since Curiosity as well. So yeah. they have all the precautions they take with that as well. So this will be interesting. This one has a it's not quite the Curiosity. It's similar. It's going to land the sky crane kind of fashion.
Yeah.
But this one has a little deployable helicopter, quadcopter that they're going to send up. And this one is going into Jezero to look specifically for life. I mean, they're going to try to cache. Return samples for another ambitious return mission, I believe 2024, 2026.
Yeah. So, very cool. And then we've got some comments.
Yeah, there's two new. I wrote about one of them. There's a bunch. We haven't had a really great naked eye comet in 2020, unfortunately, but we've had a good string of binocular comets. We've been following in the virtual star party. T2 Panstars is still very well placed in the evening. And unfortunately, the Atlas comets, Y1 and Y4, kind of disappointed a little bit. But there is one coming up that may be another good binocular comet. It's sunward right now, but there's been some good southern hemisphere photos, and it's going to be northern hemisphere at dusk. This is comet C2019 U6 Lemon. This was found by the Mount Lemmon Sky Survey outside of Tucson, another automated survey. This one, it should be topping out in the next coming weeks about fifth or sixth magnitude. It's right in that area of sextans going into Leo, so it's going to be coming. We might be able to get it for virtual star party. The elevation was a little low. I'm checking these every Sunday night to see if we can. I'm hoping with this new EV scope that I'm going to be testing, I could maybe comets are always kind of interesting to get some photos of.
Yeah.
This one, it's interesting, too, that I noticed on the research that its orbit is actually getting changed slightly. It's coming in on a 9,000 year orbit, give or take a century, and it's going out on a 5,000 year outbound. And this is because of Jupiter. And I remember back in the Hale-Bopp days, I remember hearing this little statistic that I was stuck in my head. They said that any comet coming into the inner solar system stands about a 40% chance of having its orbit altered by Jupiter. Outward, because Hale-Bopp, the same thing happened. It got shortened by a few thousand years on its orbit going outbound, and that's always kind of stuck with me. That's kind of an interesting little Jupiter doing that goaltending thing that it does.
So, there. But none of these have the potential to be the comet that that I deserve.
No,
okay.
No, there's another one. It's currently in SOHO's view, as a matter of fact, is F3 NEOWISE, discovered by the NEOWISE survey, and that one is going to be another. We get about a half dozen good binocular comets. I consider binocular between 10th and 6th magnitude.
Yeah.
You get above 6th magnitude, then things get interesting. So
yeah,
we're due. We haven't had a good where's McNaught? That went down southern hemisphere. There was W3 Lovejoy. That was southern hemisphere. Really, it's been Hale-Bopp and Hyakutake were the last good northern hemisphere. It's amazing we haven't had a good northern hemisphere comet since the advent, really, of digital astrophotography.
Interesting.
Because when you look back at it, it was just starting in its infancy at Hale-Bopp and Hyakutake. Because whenever I write about them and I look for photos, there's not really a lot of good photos of them because everybody was shooting with film.
Yeah.
And not all of these have made their way to the internet.
I don't know if I mentioned in the past during Hyakutake or Hale-Bopp, my dad's a photographer, but he shoots black and white photography, and so he took some pictures of of Hale Bopp. And then I printed out a bunch of prints of his work and sent them to a bunch of the space journalists who had helped me out early in my career. And yeah, the beautiful, beautiful pictures, black and white though, framed picture of the of this comet. But it just doesn't, like, now the technology is totally different. I can't even imagine what pictures would look like of those comets with modern techniques, modern gear, etc. It would be a
98-99 digital photography. There was still that argument out there whether digital was serious astrophotography at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's still on film. Before,
my dad shoots on film, black and white, in the in the dark.
I was shooting film back then. Yeah, I was still shooting film.
Yeah.
You don't get the pixels.
No. It's a beautiful picture. I might have one kicking around here somewhere, but I think I sent them all.
The long tracking and the hyper cooled film and it was a different world.
Then. He just shot the sky. He just took a picture of the did as long of an exposure as he could with his camera and that was it. I did
photography class in high school. You had to keep a notebook and write down the f-stop and the shutter speed on everything you shot.
Yeah, old school. All right. Well, I'm just going to briefly mention that we had another Starship explode. This was SN7. So let me. I'm just going to get the shot here so people can see. I'm going to find the sweet spot here. All right. And I'll let my my co-hosts will check this out as well. All right. So we got. So this was SN7. This was the plan was to take this to failure, and so this was fully anticipated, and they reached failure. And then in the end, where's the part where the top just totally blows off?
I actually missed this today.
And this is from Lab Padre. There's a shot where it really goes off, but
can I say it's amazing that, like, at the Boca Chica site in Texas, that there are people that actually watch from off site to see what, like, they're monitoring SpaceX just to see what they're like. I think Everyday Astronaut runs a feed out there sometimes.
I mean, I always sort of make fun of SpaceX that what Starships do is they explode. But this time, obviously, this was an intentional push the tank pressure. They had a new type of stainless steel, 304L, and the goal was to push it to and they filled it with pressurized nitrogen and just went until it cracked. And they found that number. And so now they'll know what they're working with.
I can't believe they let them get back on the horse when they've exploded them, when they weren't doing it on purpose. I mean, most of the time, everything's shut down. It takes months and months of investigation, and they can't even do anything.
No, this is the way SpaceX works, is they are just rapidly iterating through these prototypes, getting to trying to work out each of the major bugs in the system. And once they still have to get to this point that this thing can actually take off, and then they're going to go through the same thing where they're smashing them into the atmosphere and they're exploding as they're making their way through the atmosphere, and they will finally figure out a way to get them through the atmosphere. You know, it's just, I can just imagine the carnage that's going to be around the landing site of just these exploded debris of space of starships crashed down. But eventually, hopefully, they'll figure out how to make it go, and then we will be at that next step to the revolution of the fully reusable rocket, which will then change everything.
Speaking of SpaceX, there's another Starlink launch tomorrow night from the Cape.
Yeah,
I've lost track. I think
9th, 10th. Yeah,
I haven't looked at the geometry for this, but I probably will tomorrow, because I always do all that. Everybody wants to know, are we going to see the Starlink train and stuff? Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, it's weird that these are becoming normal now. So
there was a photo. I've seen some photos now of what the Starlink receiver looks like, and it.
Okay.
Kinda,
yeah, there was some. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like a plate, on a. Like a stick on a box, and the plate, I guess, moves around to receive the signal. So we're getting closer. Yeah,
they're supposed to be beta testing, I think.
I signed up, so I put my name in for the beta test.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
I hope they, like I said, the Iridiums never panned out. Those became more of a niche application kind of thing. So yeah. That was the first generation of this kind of technology. So
yeah. And speaking of Iridium, we just learned that, I forget the name of the company. Oh, forget it. Never mind. Anyway, the 3D rocket printing company, someone will post it in the chat. What is it?
Made in Space.
No. The Relativity Space. Relativity Space just signed a contract with Iridium to put up replacement satellites for that constellation. And this one that's done with 3D printing. They 3D print the actual rocket engine, which is kind of amazing. So
interesting. I missed that.
Yeah. All right. Dave, you are on my screen right now. Why don't you let us know what you're working on and where people can find out more?
What I have been working on for the past year is getting ready to come out next month, July 21st, Backyard Astronomer's Field Guide. This is entirely a star party in a book. This worked from the basic question that Fraser posed of what's in the sky tonight. I think that's the first sentence in the book. We go season by season, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, month by month. So there's 24 charts, 12 months. And then we break down all of this as naked eye. We get to do some more mythology in these sections and just where you're looking, the direction in the galaxy, the Milky Way. The idea was to have the monthly sections be naked eye. And then we went into the telescopic objects and we went down to mostly 10th magnitude. We did the sky section by section.
Perfect.
We really had to do some furious editing to get that down into one book too.
Because yeah.
This is something you would see in Burnham's Celestial Handbook or other guides. That would be several volumes that we just wanted to distill it down. And we wanted something you could use in the backyard. So we did tested under red lights, black on white maps, you know, so it's not the sexiest book maybe, but it's usable out in the field.
Well, that was the goal this time around. I mean, when we had originally come up with the first book, I had asked, like, I want something really practical, and somehow that conversation disappeared. But this time around, this book is all about it being very practical. And so
I wasn't entirely happy with the maps in the first one. The sky maps were a little, they were the best. And we just did seasons. We didn't do months in this one. This is because we put, this had solar astronomy, comets, asteroids, basically everything amateur astronomy we could think of. This, we concentrated just deep sky.
I think in retrospect, it was the right move. I think it's a great way to have one be this just like how to become an amateur astronomer and just like and it's filled with beautiful photography that you can really appreciate. And then this book is a practical tool that you take out with you and start looking at the sky. So I think the hope is one will be sit on your coffee table and the other one will be destroyed because you are taking it out into the field and you're using it. So great. And of course it's going to be out in July when we'll be on hiatus. So now is your chance.
July 21st.
Right on. I can't wait. I hope I'm on the list.
You should be. Yeah.
All right.
We've been going through and mailing out books to people.
Great.
So
yeah, I can't wait. Fantastic. Congratulations. Of course you're Astro Guys on all the things.
Yes.
Right on. All right, Pam.
Yeah. Sounds amazing. Dave, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Yeah, like I said, creating this new membership site, and I think it's going to be a little bit of a twist. I want to really put together some teams that start to figure out how to use all this great new tech and build some things that we can get out there. So, yeah, and like I said, free book.
Yeah, free book.
We need kind of the the teaser to bring you in. So come on down, Pam at everydayspacer.com.
Perfect. Michael. What are you working on?
So we are going to be doing a live stream Astronomy on Tap this coming Monday. So we are a state college chapter in Pennsylvania, but it's online. Anybody can come. So I'm at on Twitter at Michael Roderick, and I have the link for the live stream on my Twitter. So we're going to be talking about how coronavirus has affected astronomy observing and how we can actually use the sun to help us find exoplanets. And so we're going to be doing those two talks by two different astronomers. We're going to have trivia, and we're also going to be making our own astronomy-themed cocktail, which should be pretty exciting. So come out Monday, 7 p.m. Eastern time.
Fantastic.
Check us out on YouTube.
Awesome. Okay, great. And, of course, I have – Let's see. We had a new episode of The Guide to Space come out on the Proxima Centauri planets. I've got a new question show coming out tomorrow. On Friday, maybe, maybe not, we're going to have an episode on the new Trident mission that NASA has announced. And then, of course, the final star party of the season happens on... I think we've got our last episode of Astronomy Cast on Friday, the final episode of the star party on Sunday night, and then my last open space on Monday, and then the last weekly space hangout on Wednesday. So we are definitely down to the last episodes of everything. And then we will take a couple of months to recuperate. So, all right, I'm going to bring everybody up on the screen so that you can see them all here. Thank you. You know, I won't get a chance to probably talk to most of you until the next season. So I really appreciate and always enjoy working with all of you. It's been super fun. And, you know, you guys all did a great job joining us this year as our newest recruits, and I hope that you guys will stick around and continue on next year.
Thank you very much, Fraser.
Fantastic. All right. Have a great summer. All right, let's shift over into this week's. There it is. Okay, this week you saw my eyes close. All right, again, this is an interview with Elizabeth Howell. She was a writer for Universe Today. She has been a writer for Space.com and many other places. And is working on three books simultaneously about the search for life on Mars, the Canadian Space Agency history, and the and time travel. So let's get into the interview. Here we go. All right, joining us this week, I've got a good friend, Elizabeth Howell. Elizabeth, welcome to the Weekly Space Hangout. Have you been a part of this before?
I haven't done it for a long time. Yeah. I used to be a contributor to Universe Today, right? And I miss those days. It was really fun because I was so connected with the community. And now that I'm doing other things, I've sometimes miss out on the fun stuff. So yeah. It's good to be back, you know?
Yeah, no, it's tough. You've got to focus your mind for months at a time on one specific project, as opposed to being a hummingbird like the rest of us, flitting around from interest to interest. But you are working on a bunch of books, which is why we brought you this week onto the Weekly Space Hangout. Tell us what you've been up to.
Well, I just finished a book about time travel, which was released through Skyhorse Press. And so it's sort of funny right now, right? Because we're all feeling like we're in a time travel moment with all this strange stuff happening around us. So that was not known, obviously. And then the one I want to talk about today is about Mars exploration. It's called The Search for Life on Mars. It just came out yesterday as we're recording this. So that would be June 23rd, I think. And I'm really excited because it was a collaboration with an author named Nicholas Booth, who did reporting in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then obviously I'm younger. So I brought in my 2000s and so experience. And then here is the result.
And so what is the premise of the book?
The premise of the book is that the search for life on Mars has been somewhat like a detective story over the years, because you're looking at all these clues and trying to figure things out. So for example, during the Viking missions, I know you've written about this a lot on Universe Today, so folks can find it, but basically they were doing searches for life, and the way that they were doing them is still controversial today. They found stuff, but they weren't sure what they found. And so there's one group of scientists who say, oh, that's signs of life, and there's other ones who are saying, actually not. And so there's a big debate that sort of began in the 1970s and continued. And finally, in the 1990s or so and the early 2000s, we began to find signs of water on the surface. And that kind of convinced us that maybe there's something there. And that brought us into today.
And I mean, you know, we can't resolve that mystery. But what is the cutting edge now, I guess? I mean, is that what you're up to, is like the search for Mars life today? Where is the story at as of when you guys finish the book?
As we finish the book, the ExoMars mission in Europe, where Nicholas is based, was pushed off by 2 years because of some technical issues and also because of this pandemic, which is affecting all kinds of space missions. But happily, NASA's mission is still going forward. So the Perseverance rover will be launching no earlier than July 20th. It'll be landing on Mars in February. if all goes well. And the idea is it's going to be searching for signs of ancient habitability. So it's going to be looking at the rocks, it's going to be looking at the landscapes, and it will cache the most promising samples and have them ready for some other mission to come and pick up in the near future and bring them back to Earth for better analysis. So that's a cutting edge, trying to figure out how to get stuff safely from Mars to Earth without turning into some sort of a war of the world scenario. I mean, without the big aliens, we're talking about micro problems, right? You know, we're talking about viruses, which we're all really cognizant about today, right, with the pandemic. So how do we make these labs safe? How do we make sure that the spacecraft is all ready to send stuff back without causing us problems? That's really one of the big, big problems that are facing astrobiologists today.
Now, you, I mean, got a chance to talk with a bunch of the original researchers and some of the researchers who are working on this today. And I mean, I think what I find so fascinating is, like, back with the Viking missions, everybody was so excited and they did some really bold experiments to try to turn up any kind of evidence of life on Mars. And they found inconclusive results, which are like the worst kind of results. So do you feel like NASA and the researchers have sort of made a, you know, have learned a fairly powerful lesson from this? And what impact has that had on the missions now, Perseverance and things like that?
I think that what happened with Viking, now I wasn't even alive at the time starting this stuff, just to be fair.
Yeah.
But when Viking landed, I'm just going to flip off my video and flip it back on because I know I'm freezing like crazy here. Okay, there we go.
Yeah.
So there you go, technical issues. That's basically what was going on with the Viking landing, right? So it landed and they were trying to do a whole bunch of things at the same time. They had a lot of ambitious life experiments that were lined up. And I think they tried to do a little bit too much at once. And because they didn't have that stuff kind of lined up sequentially, they were trying to get a lot of stuff done very quickly. And I think that what they learned from that was to sort of take a step back and do it one thing at a time.
Right.
So for example, when the Spirit and Opportunity rovers landed back in 2004, they were basically like, are there any rocks out there that might have been formed in water? Are there any features that might have been formed in water? They weren't even wondering about life, you know, back then,
yeah,
per se, just whether the environment had water in it. That was basically one of their main features. And then Curiosity came along in 2012. I'm just going with the NASA missions because it's easier. So Curiosity came along in 2012. And then it was like, okay, so we know that there's water on Mars, but how far does it go? So right now it's climbing a mountain and it's finding out it's actually going very far up this mountain. It's kind of scary. So then we got Perseverance coming along and it's saying, all right, we know that the environment was habitable, but were there microbes in it? So these are one step at a time as opposed to everything in one package. So I think that's what we learned from Viking.
Yeah. And do you, you know, is, are people hopeful, do you think? Do you think that Perseverance is going to be the machine that's going to be able to find conclusive evidence that life was acting on Mars in the past, or do you think it's going to be some follow-on mission?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Perseverance is caching stuff, right? It's putting stuff aside for some other mission to pick up and bring back to Earth. So really, it's going to be a collaboration between at least three sets of teams. So there'll be the Perseverance team that gets the spacecraft to the surface and roving around and picking up stuff. Then we have the sample return team that brings the stuff back to Earth. And then we have the Earth laboratories that are checking out all of the samples to see what's going on. So it won't actually be one mission at that point. It's going to be a minimum of three. And I think that really shows the importance of doing multi-mission sort of exploration. You don't just go with one idea in mind. You sort of go, okay, I'm going to do step one, step two, step
right,
three, step
right,
four. And the big challenge, of course, is making sure there's a continuity in terms of funding to make that happen.
Yes.
I mean, thankfully at JPL, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they have people that stay there a long time. They tend to do more than one mission. So the personnel are in place. But does NASA get the funding year to year to make that happen is really the big question.
And we've seen the implications of funding coming and going on other missions, and especially all of the crewed exploration of the solar system, switching between the Constellation program and the Space Launch System. We're going to asteroids, we're going to the moon, we're going to Mars. And you do need that long term because it is this discovery over decades to build a conclusive case. Because I think that was the thing that Viking taught them, was like, an inconclusive result is pretty much worthless, no matter how exciting you've found at the end of the day. If you can't, if it's inconclusive, then you can't stake anything on it. And so you've got to be sure, even if you're going for something that's a little less ambitious. And I think that's definitely driving.
Yeah, I think the problem is, this is sort of the way that NASA works. NASA, of course, is situated within a federal budget, and that budget needs to be accountable to a public and to politicians that may not necessarily understand how science works. Now, scientists, you and I understand scientists, we've worked with many of them, we have science backgrounds. We know that inconclusive results are a part of science. You know, you do things and you may not find exactly what you're looking for. That's still considered progress. Unfortunately, politicians and the public don't see it the same way, yeah. Right? They see it as a failure. And that is one of the reasons why there was such a gap between Viking and those missions of the 1990s with Mars. You know, people were just saying, why bother going back? Yeah. It appears there's not very much going on there. Thankfully, we made the decision to do it, and we found the water, and we found other signs that might be indicating life on the surface. But, you know, that one mission, as great as it was, it really had the wrong impression, unfortunately, among people not trained in science.
So let's talk a little bit about your other book as well, which is Time Travel. what possessed you to do a book on time travel?
I wonder that myself, because it's such an ambitious project, and there's so many ways that you can attack it. But what I decided to do was to sort of say what really inspired me when I was 13 years old, 14 years old, when I was watching Apollo 13 and all those movies. And I was watching Back to the Future as well. You know, that was one of my favorite movies growing up. My husband and I were just rewatching the first one last night and having huge nostalgia because it's so well done to this day. It explains time loops and all sorts of other aspects. So my inspiration in going after it was really to help that next generation of people. So those who might be sort of in that teenager or sort of preteen stage, find a bit of science that excites them. So they may not end up being space journalists like I did. They may end up doing something completely different. So you can't even imagine the social media is taking off in a way where it's really need information. Yeah. But just as long as they got that scientific knowledge and that scientific understanding and there's something that excites them, I don't care, you know? So I went into time travel and I found all these franchises all the way from basically when things were being written down. So we're talking H.G. Wells and all
Right.
Up to the present. I mean, I even covered Bill and Ted because it's coming back, right?
Awesome.
There's going to be a new Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
And that was why it just was a journey to sort of show people how science fiction works and how they're sort of borrowing from science at times.
It's funny. I have a very similar approach to this as well, which is that I can see this journey that people go through when they show up in the comments in the chat on the videos and the stuff that I do is they're like, you know, when are we going to have warp drives and how do wormholes work and time travel and all this kind of stuff. So clearly science fiction has got them enthusiastic about these concepts and it made them curious for more. I have to be the bearer of bad news that probably none of this stuff's going to work. I'm sorry. We're never going to travel at faster than light speeds. To the best of our understanding that the universe is incomprehensibly large and we're going to spend our time scratching away at the edges, hoping to understand little bit by little bit. But welcome. And now let's get into the fun part, which is when you start to really understand what's actually going on, you can really appreciate the discoveries that are made and the improvements and the increases and as each little piece of knowledge gets added to our collective. And so thinking about time travel and thinking about the implications of paradoxes and so on. So who has actually done the best time travel concept, do you think?
Oh, you know, it's so tough because some people were going more realistic and some people were going less realistic, but maybe I'll just go with the one that I found the most inspiring that has inspired a lot of people. So today it was a deliberate decision. Actually, I'm wearing a Starfleet. I can't really see it, but anyway, that's a Starfleet symbol on me. And it's because Star Trek just was so fun in terms of time loops. My favorite Star Trek of all time, which is many people's favorite, is Star Trek IV. It's the one where they go back in time and there's whales and they're trying to rescue the whales and bring them into the future because there's no whales where they live and there's a problem happening with it, right? And just the confusion when all these people from the future are showing up in 1986 or so Los Angeles, right? And they have no idea how to get on a bus and pay for things. Like Spock says at what point, what does it mean exact change? You know, like just all these little things that we understand in our culture, but in a moneyless future, what is that going to mean, right? So the reason I'm bringing that up is that Star Trek has inspired so many people to go in different directions, right? Some of them ended up being in the entertainment industry. Some of them literally ended up being astronauts. Some of them ended up in the space program.
Yep.
Some of them ended up like you and I, right?
Yeah, some of them ended up being science journalists.
Exactly. Yeah. Some ended up being science journalists, and they're still pumping out franchises. Picard just came out.
Yep.
Star Trek Discovery is still new. All of the Star Treks, I think almost, are on Netflix Canada right now, and probably most of them are in the U.S. at the moment, right? They still inspire somehow.
So I have a crazy story. My wife and I are watching Deep Space Nine. We're going through Deep Space Nine now, which is the one franchise that I always bailed out. I always bail out early. And a lot of people said, no, stick through it, keep going. So we're into season three now, and we're on the episode where Sisko and Bashir go back to Earth in 2024 and help lead a revolution that changes sort of social inequality in the United States. And I highly recommend you watch this again in the time that we're in right now. Like, the technology is hilariously wrong, but the social issues that they're dealing with, absolutely prescient. It's a stunning, you watch this show set in 2024 that was filmed back in the mid-1990s, and they totally got where society was heading and what changes needed to happen. It is that just gave me chills watching it. So I think that's what made it great. The hand wavy chronoton particle singularity explosion, it's all just nonsense. So using time travel to tell a compelling story is wonderful. Do you think that anybody has done a good job technically of dealing with the flailing octopus of a plot that is time travel?
You know, that's a good question, and I remain kind of stuck, because most of the time travel franchises that I'm thinking of, at least off the top of my head, are sort of moving the science aside for the sake of story. And my fear is, whenever you're reading something and you start to get super, super technical, you end up with issues where it just becomes boring, right? And deliberately, I was choosing things that had good stories in my book. So I was sort of excluding those ideas that were more scientifically rigorous at times, although I was showing about science with that. So I'll just kind of leave that as a cliffhanger and say, I'd have to do some more research and think about it. Because I think that a good story and good science, they're sort of a good pathway for a while. But if you begin to get too exacting, then it kind of gets in the way of things. But I must say, there are authors that are better or worse. Like Isaac Asimov, for example, he did a good story that I talked about there, where he talks about the butterfly effect, which we still talk about.
No, that was Ray Bradbury.
Sorry, Ray Bradbury. Yeah. What am I saying? Ray Bradbury had the butterfly effect, right? So I have that in the book. And so that might be one example where you're getting closer to the science. And of course, anything Isaac Asimov too, not that story, but anything Isaac Asimov would be closer to the science. But again, even they make sacrifices, and they know it.
Yeah,
they
I would say from a movie television. Have you seen the movie Primer?
No, tell me about this.
Oh yeah, it's a movie that came out back in the mid 1990s, I think, early 2000s, and it is about these two guys that set up a time travel machine in a nearby warehouse, and then use it initially together, and then after a while, start to use it independently to mess with each other's use of the time travel machine. And it has led to whole websites dedicated to trying to work out what was actually going on. And so when you watch it, it is confusing and perfect in that way, because I feel like it captures just how mind-bendingly difficult it is when you really think about the implications of time travel. So Primer, check it out. One last thing that I would want to bring up is the fact that, of course, we're both Canadians, and you are also working on another book about the Canadian space industry, which is great. I can't wait.
Yeah, now that one is the one I've wanted to write ever since I was 13, 14. I felt that there needed to be more books about the Canadian space program, and not just about when they're in space, because it's just a fraction of their careers. What are they doing for the rest of their time when they're working on the ground? What kind of stuff are they working on? And so that's what I asked these astronauts. I talked to practically every astronaut in the program, and I had some pretty interesting imposter syndrome moments for myself, because some of these astronauts have since gone on to other careers. And so one of the scenes I talk about in the book, for example, is going to Rideau Hall to talk to our head of state in Canada, Julie Payette, who used to be an astronaut.
Yeah, who's an astronaut.
Now she's Governor General. She lives in this fancy old Victorian mansion, basically in downtown Ottawa, where I live, and I'm pulling up at the gate in my little, you know, hatchback car. Oh, there. I got my thrift store clothes on. And so anyway, it was a great experience. Yeah. She just was so knowledgeable and so friendly, but just the environment was very different than what I ever expected to do as a journalist, right? And that's what's fun about it, asking these people what they do when they're not in space, because they don't get to talk about it enough.
Yeah.
You know, I was in space for 10 days, but while I was on the ground for 2 years, I helped develop this system, or I helped work with these engineers. And so that's what I'm looking forward to telling the story about. And I've got practically everyone in there, from Chris Hadfield all the way up to our newer astronauts, Jenny and Josh and Jeremy.
Oh,
and David.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's great. And that's it's a thing that most people don't know. You know, Canadians, we walk among you. You know, can't tell us apart from the Americans. But Canada does have a rich heritage in space exploration. Elizabeth, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. If people want to find out more about what you're working on and your books, where can they go?
The easiest way is Twitter. We're all on Twitter. We all like bantering around with each other. Yep. So my Twitter handle is Howell Space, H-O-W-E-L-L Space. For those of you a certain age, it's the same spelling as the Gilligan Island Howells. That might be helpful.
There you go. Howell Space.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Space. Well, I look forward to your various books. And definitely when your book on the Canadian Space Agency comes out, we'll do another catch-up call. And hopefully I can help people. At least I can understand better the history of my nation's space program. Elizabeth, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Good luck with everything.
All right. See you. Bye.
All right. Take care.